Welcome to Witch Lit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witch Lit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. All our titles can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. If you'd like to support Witch Lit, please consider buying us a coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Althea Sebastiani is a spirit worker and religious educator whose work focuses on helping people navigate the realities of deep spiritual practice. They emphasize being in right relationship with the other than human and developing the psychic spiritual skills necessary to support direct experiences with the land, ancestors, and the gods. They are the author of 4 books: Alive with Spirits, The Path and Practice of Animistic Witchcraft, A Witch's Guide to Spellcraft, Paganism for Beginners, The Complete Guide to Nature-Based Spirituality for Every New Seeker, and By Rust of Nail and Prick of Thorn, The Theory and Practice of Effective Home Warding. Althea Sebastiani, welcome to Witch Lit.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited to have you on, and listeners won't know this, but we know that it's taken us like a year and a half to get here.
Oh God, so long. It's been so long.
Yeah. But we're here now, and you have this beautiful book that we can talk about. But our first question for everybody on the show, you know, especially in the world of social media and short attention spans, why still write? Why still write books?
Oh God. You know, I think as a writer, that's a kind of a question that you end up facing fairly often, not just because with every single little thing that you're writing, you reach that point where you question your career and why you did this, why you're ever writing, because the words are hard. They just end up being so hard. And God, I don't know. I think at this point I keep writing because I feel kind of compelled to. I can't imagine myself not writing. I'm kind of always writing around like life and just things, you know? Yeah, there's something about just taking your thoughts too and putting them in that tangible form, you know, and being able to hold it. That is just, There's something kind of thrilling about that. There's something deeply fulfilling. And maybe it's just being, you know, and a library kid and just always in love with books. So it's just seeing that book with your name on it too. It just kind of has that really fulfilling thing to it.
So what was that like the first time you saw your name on a book?
It was weird. It was really weird. At the Warding book was my first one, by Rust of Nail and Prick of Thorn, but it wasn't my first published book, just my first one to end up as a paperback. So it was like, I think it was like book number 8 or 9, because I have a bunch of fiction out under pen names. And it was still weird because it's like, wow, it's like my first book, but it's not my first book. You know? But every book, it's kind of like that too, like with the new one, with Alive with Spirits too, just seeing and holding it. And it's now book number 4, but every time it feels like it's the first book, you know, just kind of fun.
Yeah, that feeling never gets old, I think, of when you feel, when you, like you said, when you hold that like actual paper book in your hands the first time, is it's always like, did I do this?
Yeah. And then you look at it like, I don't remember writing any of this. It's so nice.
We talked a little bit beforehand, like just the time scale of publishing, like it makes it really weird because your brain has already moved on to the next project or thing. And then this comes out and you're like, oh yeah, I did write that and I need to talk to people about it.
Right. And the editing process can be so brutal, just emotionally, for no reason really, but except that it kind of is. And so you get to the end of it and you're just like, okay, I'm done. And you put the emotions away and all of the thoughts about the book, and then you have to talk about it to people and you don't know what's in there anymore.
So you've self-published and you published with 2 different publishers. So what do you feel like you've learned, I guess, in that journey, or what would you want to share about that?
Oh gosh. Publishing is hard no matter who does it. That's for sure. Whether it's self-published or traditional published, it's hard. So if you're trying to do it on your own or have a first book with a publisher, just it's always hard. It's never not hard. I, Yeah, and in a lot of ways, the writing process can be a lot easier. And that's even keeping in mind that, we all will have those nights where we're sitting there trying to write and this so frustrating. You get up, you walk around the house, you're like, I'm so stupid. Why am I doing this? Why do I keep putting myself through this? But publishing is still harder than that.
Yeah, it is kind of, I don't, it's funny to me. I'm not like purporting everyone go read Hemingway. I don't think he's for everyone. But I do love that writing's easy. You just sit in front of the typewriter and open a vein. Like, yeah, that's kind of what it's like. Except most of us don't do it on typewriters anymore. But the sentiment is definitely the same.
And it's a good point though too, because you do need to just let it flow, basically. Words are cheap. It's the ideas that are really important that carry that weight and that people connect with and then buy your stuff and spread it around and talk to people about it. With the writing process, you just got to write it because you can always delete what doesn't work, and sometimes you do need to hammer out 200 words that are just utter crap and then delete them and then write the good words.
I think for me, the challenge has been like with each book is like knowing that that's part of the process. Because I always get to this point where like, I don't know how to write a book. What am I doing? And then you kind of go, wait, you've done this six times. You do know how to do this. This is just the crap part.
You reach that point where you're like, do I know how to write a book? Did I actually write those? Did I write them well? You start questioning everything. And then you finish it and it's fine.
And then you just get to it, and then you sit down and you're like, I'm gonna do this to myself again.
New book project. I
mean,
Oh, the excitement though of a new book idea.
And I don't think, I mean, I don't, people always joke about like, oh, if it's so horrible, why do you write? And I was like, because, yes, there are parts of it that are really difficult and hard. But for me, it's like, I also don't know what else to do. Like, it's what I do.
Well, what else? It's just such a compulsion in the end.
I mean, it's better than a lot of other compulsions, so I'll just go with
It
that.
is. I mean, sometimes you definitely have to wonder if it's like emotionally healthy because it's definitely a workout, but
Yeah, I mean, it's hard on you emotionally. It's hard on you physically. Just physically writing, sitting, and doing the job is
the
hard.
sitting part.
But so this book. So what was the compulsion for this book?
Oh my goodness. I was actually in the middle of doing a reading. A big part of like the work that I do is as a spirit worker, and I throw the bones and do spiritual counseling. And so I'm basically, I'm sitting on my bed. I've got my bone kits spread out before me. I'm in the middle of a reading, like talking to spirits. And suddenly I remember I'm writing the reading out and I stop. And I have this idea right then. So I start flipping through pages, getting to a fresh page in my mind, and I start jotting out the idea of the book. And it was just in the middle of that, and it was so good, and I knew I needed to write it, and I fleshed out like way too much. It was a bad use of time, but the idea was there, and I had to get it out. But then I kind of sat on it for a few months, so I kind of talked myself out of doing it. I'm like, no, I'm not going to write a book on animism. I don't need to write a book on animism. The world doesn't need me to read a book on animism. It's fine. And then the compulsion came back, and I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to have to write a book on animism here. So I started like playing around with bits of it, trying to put together a cohesive outline. Really, I couldn't do it. I ended up taking half of what my outline was and putting it to the side. I don't know if it'll be another book or what. It didn't work. And then I started pulling out bits and writing them into workshops and just kind of testing the ideas with my students. And unfortunately, they loved it. They loved it a lot, so I kept doing
Yes,
that. And
another
then,
push toward the compulsion to making a book.
yeah, exactly. When other people like what you write, it doesn't help you to convince yourself not to do it. And then I ended up putting it all together as a course so I could test out the exercises, which was really good. All of the exercises were tested with something like 150 people or so at first. So yeah, lots of feedback, tweaking and things. And then I don't know, then Wiser showed up in my email and they're like, hey, do you think now is a good time? Do you want to publish with us? And I'm like, okay, I'll play along. Here we are.
Yeah, I was going to ask how it ended up at Wiser, but that I I feel like that
Literally,
story.
they emailed me. Otherwise, I'd probably still be sitting here wondering
It
if I
feels
should
like,
publish a book on animism.
I don't know, it's so weird to me how many people I've talked to on the show, especially, you know, I mean, already you're writing occult books and, you know, there's the woo element that comes anyway. But then so there's so many of those stories, like, you know, they approached me or I was sat next to someone at a conference or, you know, it's just like these things just kind of happen. And I was like, I think, you know, for writers who are discouraged about getting published, it almost sounds like, oh, you have to get struck by lightning. That's not really always how it works.
No. And like, especially within our niche too, we are in another publishing boom. So if you have a book idea, just put a proposal together and submit it. You know, Weiser and Llewellyn both have their submission guidelines on their websites. Just if you want to try, then fucking try, do it. Yeah. It was literally the worst.
Yeah.
You wait 3 weeks to get an email back, you know?
Yeah.
And you can always self-pub.
Yeah. And I mean, I think they're, you know, kind of like you being hybrid, like there's advantages to having an editor that you don't have to pay for, you know, just part of the process versus having an editor that you have to pay. And, you know, but it's good and bad. Like you said, there's pros and cons to publishing yourself and publishing traditionally. And it's going to look different for every book and every person. So.
Yeah. And it's definitely okay to do both, to do, you know, an indie pub book, do a trad pub book. There's nothing wrong with indie books.
No, not at all.
Some people really look down on them as they're not real books, but I mean, they absolutely are. They have covers, there's pages, there's typed words on them. There's many typed words in them, you know?
Yeah.
Very real. They can be just as impactful.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of authors, you know, especially I think if you talk to even hybrid authors who publish traditionally and do indie publishing or self-publishing, oftentimes you make a little more on the books you publish yourself, even though you may sell fewer of them just because there's no middle person.
Exactly. Yeah. So depending with your distributor, you can make 60 to 80% royalties on one book.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I mean, just for your livelihood, there's considerations to you, I guess. But.
Yeah. And the fact that it's indie doesn't mean it's not going to sell. I mean, you can find my warding book on the Walmart website. Like, it's really easy to get them distributed and available, and people will find them and they will buy them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a last resort.
Yeah, the first time I saw one of my indie published books on Target's website, I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess that happens.
So weird. It's very weird. I take screenshots the first time I come across them. I'm always like, what's that? That's my book at Walmart. That's my book at Target. So weird.
Well, I want to talk about the book itself because I just so loved this book. And really, you know, sometimes you just get a book at the right time. You know, a book just finds you at the right time. And having a podcast makes reading books artificial a lot because I have somebody, so I'm going to read the book because they're going to be on the show and it's not necessarily something I would have picked up in that moment, but this one like just landed at the perfect time. And I think partly we talked a little bit before, like I moved during the pandemic and was just kind of at sea for a couple years and I've really started to have a sense of place now. And so this book was just like, oh yeah, you know?
Yeah.
So that part was great. And one of the things I love about the book, you can tell you're a teacher when you read the book. Not just because there's like, I was trying to explain this to someone. One of the things I love about the book and I really want to adopt in my own writing that I was so impressed with is that you make such an effort to make everything accessible. No matter where people are, mentally, physically, you know, like just to make sure that they can find a place to do the work, whatever
their book can meet them where they are too, especially.
And it was just so beautiful to read that. And also just like the gentle reminders, like, you know, sometimes paying attention to your breath can, you know, if you have asthma or you have something else, it can, you know, cause problems and just be aware of that. I think it's the first time I've ever seen that in a book. And as someone with asthma, I was just like clapping when I read it.
It was something that I added in a few years ago because a lot of my students are disabled or have chronic illness in some way, and I do too. And when you just live in your life, a lot of times you kind of forget the accommodations that you make for yourself you know, and you kind of live with the assumption maybe that like, oh, it's just those are your issues, your limitations. You know, other people are totally fine, you know. So you don't think about how those little extra steps should be added in or mentioned. But then like talking with my students and we're like talking about the accommodations that we make for ourselves with doing like the same exercise. And like everybody had something to say, you know, everybody had something that they were doing to change it, which was great because then for me as a teacher, it helps me to better realize what the core things are and what things have to happen in order to get the same results or the desired results, at least, you know, out of that exercise. So, yeah, really good conversations. I love.
Oh, yeah. And it was such a delight to read. And like, even like breaking, like, here's the paragraph of what, and then breaking it into steps. I mean, just things that I think a lot, like you said, if you're doing that for yourself, you don't think about it. That's something else that somebody might want or need. So I just really appreciated that aspect of the book. Just like the actual, I guess, technical aspect of the book was delightful to read. And I think one of my favorite sections is when you talk about man-made objects, the spirits of man-made objects. Because I feel like it's such a weird conversation in occult spaces, especially in pagan witchcraft spaces. Do you want to
No,
talk
it
about
really
that a little
is.
bit?
Oh gosh.
Or a lot?
I am I'm just going to say I have so many thoughts. I don't even know what a good starting point is. I mean, it makes sense within like paganism and then the intersecting witchcraft community where the appeal to nature fallacy is really strong. And it makes sense, you know, because we prize nature, the natural world. We kind of put that, you know, on a higher place in terms of priorities and things. But it really bites us in the ass then, because we kind of create this othering then where it's the natural world and then it's humans, you know? We still cling to that exceptionalism that, you know, we're not part of nature, even though everyone likes to say, oh no, we're part of nature. We don't act like it. And saying it over and over again as an affirmation that humans are part of nature doesn't fix the fucking problem, you know, when it's not evident in our actions, it's not evident in the way that we treat just our possessions. You know, we don't act like our creations are part of nature, even though everything that we make is made of materials that are from the natural world. You know, we're not so special that we can just make something out of thin air. You know, we're taking parts of the land, we're changing them as beings that also come from the land, and we're just creating something new, same as like a wasp making a nest. You know, it's the same. What is a city? It's just an anthill. You know, it's a big termite mound. It's just the land's been changed and creatures live in it.
And I think that is, to me, it's like, you know, there has been this conversation over the last few years, and I've noticed it in books I've read, and you know, in social media, when people talking about this, you know, nature with a capital N is somehow separate, you know, and then really trying to reclaim that. I mean, looking at indigenous practice and things like that. And I don't, you know, yes, I think learning about the indigenous people where you live and how they view the land and how they work, you know, within that framework is good. But I think sometimes it's really hard as someone outside of that to really understand it in a way an indigenous person would look at it. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but I do think it is there. Oh, like you said, I have so many thoughts and they're kind of all jumbled, but just
It's a
trying
big topic.
to reconnect and not, I mean, I think one of the things you said in the book is that like when we differentiate man-made things, then they are disposable. And that's part of like our bad relationship with the land is that we have disposable possessions. And like, you know, I think I've said this recently, like every toothbrush you ever owned is in a landfill somewhere,
Oh God, yeah.
you know, and like we have an impact through our possessions.
Yeah. And if you think about it too, if man-made creations are disposable, it helps to underscore the idea that humans themselves are disposable. And we see that attitude carried in then with our relationships with each other. And then we take that too, that dysfunction, and we put it back on the land too. And it's just this horrible cycle.
I mean, I think weirdly, one of the things I've enjoyed, although unfortunately she caught so much flack because I think people didn't understand where she was coming from, but Marie Kondo's idea about things that spark joy and thanking things that you're releasing from your life And, you know, that the fact that she is Shinto and that was part of, you know, that's part of her religious practice. But I think, you know, when transposed on Westerners, it kind of seemed twee or something.
We lack the context for it. It doesn't make sense. It seems silly and childish, you know, on the level of talking to a stuffed animal, you know, when you're little and sick or something.
And I was like, no, I mean, that's like deep spiritual practice.
Yeah.
And it just kind of got, you know, like this weird short shrift because people didn't, like you said, didn't have context for it. But I think that it's weirdly also opened people's eyes a little bit too, I think, in ways.
Yeah, maybe. It's been interesting to see that, you know, I kind of watched from a distance. I didn't read the book or watch her show or anything, but I would watch the conversations around her.
Right, and like, exactly.
The way the interest would rise and then fall like that. Mm-hmm. What things people would get especially mad about, you know, like I believe she suggested something like tearing out pages of the books and people were getting just furious about that.
Like, oh, you don't need all these books.
Yeah.
I'm like, but if they spark joy, then she's not going to argue with you. I mean, that was kind of, you know, everything was kind of taken out of context. And I was like, you know, if it's joyful for you in your life to be surrounded by books, then there's not a problem with that. It's when it's a problem to you is when it becomes clutter or, you know, dysfunctional.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, just taking that out of context, people get precious about books. And I mean, I do too. But, you know, sometimes things have to be recycled.
No, they really do. It's one of the nice things about moving. It really helps you to like reprioritize your relationship with the quantity of books that you have.
Yeah. And there's always someone else who will benefit by having that book given to them or finding it at, you know, a secondhand bookstore or something, you know.
So
books have lives long beyond us, I think. Both as writers and possessors of books. So one of the things I've mentioned before on the show and I've talked about with other people is like, it feels like as a writer, like every book kind of turns into its own spirit of the book as you're writing it. And then as those copies go out in the world and someone reads them, then they become their own spirit for that person. Have you thought about that in your work, like in your writing?
Honestly, no. And I feel like I should have. I'm not thinking about it because that's kind of like the same attitude that we attribute to like tarot decks too, how there's this spirit of like all the tarot and then each individual deck. And I haven't with my books. I don't know if that's just because I don't like, you know, have the same relationship that other people do because I'm not reading it and highlighting or just, you know, writing angry notes in the margins.
Like you had your relationship with it before.
My relationship was emotional turmoil and pounding on keys on my keyboard and then getting up, walking around and losing my cups of tea and finding more tea. And you know, mine was a process.
I always love that moment when you go to put your coffee or tea in the microwave and there's one in there already that you warmed up and forgot about.
I actually broke myself with the habit of microwaving tea. I went and got I got my cast iron kettle back out of storage. I have it on the stove and I'm boiling water every single time now.
Nice.
Oh, that's self-care.
But your kettle probably appreciates it being out of the box, being out of storage.
Right? It's a good friend.
So one of the other things I wanted to ask you about, and this is kind of tangential to writing, but I feel like because you do have like a public presence on social media, like how do you manage that relationship? Like, I feel like it's uniquely fraught in this time to be kind of, you know, public in a way that writers were never really public like that before. So how do you navigate that?
The last few years, I've definitely gotten more private. I've really pulled back a lot, like, on that other app that, you know, no longer exists and we don't talk about. I was very active and I loved, you know, the little pocket of witches and pagans and polytheists that I'd surrounded myself with there. And I loved just hurtling words into the void, you know, because it didn't matter what time of the night or day it was. There's always going to be someone around. And that was cool. It really had like an old school, like GeoCities chat room feel to it in a lot of ways, you know, and I don't know. I really have pulled back now. I don't know how to explain, but social media feels like so much more pressure filled now. it feels more like the performance is expected, and I'm just a little too neurodivergent and awkward to manage that consistently. It's so weird. I open up an app and I just have no idea what to post, you know? And you can only do promotions so much before it just feels like that's all you're doing. And, you know, there's only so many cat photos you can post, and just, I don't know. I've kind of fallen into, like, if I don't have anything that seems particularly valuable to say right now, I'm just not saying anything.
Yeah, it just feels like it shifted over time. Like you said, like early on, like it was fun. And, you know, initially, I think a lot of us just connected with the people we already knew because it was new. And now there is this, like, know. I mean, part of me just wants to go, it's the capitalism, you know, like it's become performative and monetized. And, you know, you're trying to make a living doing your writing or your art or whatever it is that's brought you to social media. And like you said, you can only do so many promotions before it's just an ad site. So, like, how, like, and I just feel like a lot of people are pulling away because it has changed so much. Like, you know, there's a little part of me, you know, and maybe saying this, you know, in context of animism is maybe a bad thing. I feel like we created a monster.
Oh no. I mean, if you think about it, 'cause like what is an algorithm but an egregore in a way? It's Yeah, 'cause just the vibes are bad, you know? The vibes are bad. There's just been so much changes with the social media apps lately. And I mean, we all knew it was going to happen. The pressure for individual people just living their lives to be a brand and have, you know, set parameters for what they're posting when they're not a business, they're not promoting anything. There was no way that was ever going to work out well. And we're really kind of seeing the aftermath of that, or not the aftermath, but the consequences of that. And then with the whole boom during lockdown at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw a huge surge of people who were understandably, you know, looking to make money any way that they could. So there was this huge rise of diviners and astrologers, just people who were suddenly going pro in order to try to make some sort of money to take care of themselves and their families. And like that's shifting too now, because we see those a lot of people are closing up shop and ending their businesses, no longer providing services or teaching or making products. And it's a weird kind of liminal space. And you know, at the time of recording right now for us, we're really getting close to the election, and that adds in its own kind of complication to the emotional kind of sphere of everything right now.
Like
So
that's what you're bombarded with when you open an app right now.
And then not to mention the general world events going on right now, it's not a comfy, cozy place out there for us.
No. I mean, and just like, yeah, we say world events, literally world events. Like, you know, there's a laundry list of things that
There
are
really
going
is right
on.
now.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I've talked about this with lots of folks, and you know, part of me just wants to pull back 100% and be like, I'm done with social media and just go away and, you know, turn into JD Salinger or something. But I'm like, I don't know how you make that work in today's like marketplace of ideas.
So I've definitely thought about it too, especially with now like no longer being a hermit in the desert, you know, living in a tiny traveling house. Like part of me is like, no, I could do that again. It's fine. I'll just disappear from the world and I'll just not talk to anybody and I'll just throw out a book every year and it'll be fine. But I don't actually think it could work.
I want to think it can work, but I don't see how. Like, I feel like, you know, and I mean, part of the reason I started the podcast, because I was like, can I do this instead of social media? But then you kind of have to still promote the podcast.
You gotta do extra social media now.
So it's like, yeah, I have another account and I have, you know, so it's, yeah, it's a strange place to be as a creative right now. Like, and you know, with the advent of AI, you know, I think a lot of creatives are kind of going, what What do we do?
Yeah. It's really just such a weird thing to watch come mm-hmm. into the conversations too. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Yeah.
Over these next few months and few years.
Yeah. It's been interesting to watch the lawsuits pop up around, you know, plagiarism and theft of creative ideas to basically
which is
feed.
Interesting because, you know, because in publishing, like the plagiarism's always been there. I mean, ever since the ebook boom, you know, back mm-hmm. in, oh God, what, 2012, I think it was yeah. when it, like the big peak was like, and even with just like content writing and copywriting and spun articles, spun books, they've always been there. This is kind mm-hmm. of in a way, just a different version of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go on Amazon right now, you can find a spun version of my book.
Yeah.
Like it's for sale. It's got some reviews. Some people love it. I'm good for them. I don't know. In some ways, it's just, it's a new version of something that's always been around.
Yeah. It's just like hyper-derived or something.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's been made more accessible to the masses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some of those uh-huh. arguments about, you know, like not allowing AI or AI, you know, democratizes art. And I'm like, I don't think that word means what you think it means. It's like, you know, being able to tell a computer to draw something for you does not make you an artist.
No.
And people I'm like sorry, to argue. It doesn't. Like, it doesn't.
They like yeah. to argue about how, like, oh, if you're against AI, then you just must hate disabled people because it makes their lives better. It's like, okay, could you like advocate for like other things? There's yeah. so many things you could advocate for.
I mean, yeah, speech to text has been around forever.
Yeah. Like,
I mean, not forever, but for a long time, we've had text to speech or speech to text, you know, dictation, like mm-hmm. all of that has, and that is a kind of large language model form, but it's not creating a book whole cloth or taking yeah. jobs away from people necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not learning based on like other people's already published artwork that they have right. no say in at all.
Right. Yeah. Like I used to read for Books for the Blind in Tennessee when I lived in Tennessee. And, you know, we would read novels that didn't have audiobooks, which there's less call for that. So we wound up doing like a lot of magazines and newspapers and stuff that there's not really a voiced, you know, way that people yeah, can do that.
Makes sense.
But it was great. And it was a really good way to connect with people. And it was a great experience. And I was like, AI could just end that basically.
Yeah.
You know. And then I use a large language model program to do the captions for the podcast, to do the transcripts and the captions for YouTube. Like I don't pay a person to do that, which would have been someone's job. So, I mean, it is a fraught relationship.
Yeah, it is. Because in some ways you don't even realize the things that you're using that are mm-hmm. actually like what we would call AI, because it is language learning models. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, like grammar check mm-hmm. on Word is a large language model program.
Yeah.
It's a weird, I think we're in a weird spot still. And I'm curious to see how things shake out.
It's really curious. A changing landscape.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. Like, I mean, and again, I saw this thing on the internet, I think on Threads a couple of days ago. It's like AI is like plastic. Like it's terrible for the environment, but it has some really good applications like in medicine and science.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh,
that's a good analogy.
That's a
yeah.
great way to think about it. And it I was is. Like, yes, you know, there are places where it is really could be incredibly useful, like dealing with large mathematical problems and things like that, that we just don't have literally the human brain capacity to do. But do I want it to write poetry for me? No. Like,
no. Yeah, no, personally, I don't want to read the robot poetry.
No.
There's too many good books to spend time on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's just such a funny place to be. And I don't know. There, mm-hmm. Like you said, writing is fraught for so many reasons.
Oh my gosh.
It's like the work itself, publishing, things that affect publishing, like AI and, you know, conglomeration yeah. and all of those things. Like it's just such a strange landscape. But I mean, I'm sure everyone in their field feels that way a little bit right now too.
Oh yeah, I would imagine too, especially since people keep trying to find new ways to apply AI to mm-hmm.
Dentists might be safe. I don't know. Lawyers might not be. Dentists might be. Like there's.
Oh, that's a weird visual. Because of course, like obviously AI is not like the robots that we've all made jokes about, you know, from the 80s, like taking over the world. It's not like the Terminator. But at the same time, you say AI dentist, and I'm picturing like a robot in there with a drill.
Like, okay, this is new and exciting. Yeah. Like it's just a funny it's a funny place to be. Oh. But I haven't asked this of anybody on the show for a while, but I feel like you might have an interesting answer. If not, that's okay too. But you know, I think a lot of us do have some kind of ritual around writing because it takes a lot of time. It and really requires does. A lot of concentration and focus. So do you have like something that you've ritualized around your writing?
I don't know, I'm trying to think. I mean, nothing that's particularly spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's really just the standards of like, try to hide from my kids, try to have a quiet spot, make sure, you know, the laptop's charged, make sure I've got tea. Mm-hmm. Make sure I go to the bathroom first so I don't have to pee like 5 minutes in. Just really practical things.
Like all the distractions are somehow just put away.
Eliminate distractions.
Yeah.
Try to focus.
I think that that is its own ritual. Just like you're almost like creating a space in which to work. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've kind of gotten iffy on music too. Like sometimes I have to have some sort of like drowning out background sounds, but otherwise sometimes I just need the general quiet, you know. Mm-hmm. If it's somehow actually quiet and I can have the windows open, that's always nice. You can hear the wind.
Yeah, I love having the windows open. Mm-hmm. We have a wind chime in the backyard and it's like the most soothing thing. I really like, it's funny you say that, like trying to drown. Like I used to write in cafes a lot because the white noise would really help.
Yeah.
But I don't like to sit in a cafe for a long time since COVID. And I can't write outside of my computer because I can't see. my vision is terrible, and so that just adds a complication to it. But one of the things I have discovered is like drone ambient music. So sometimes I will listen to that because the pieces are so long. There's no loop. Like I can't listen to things on a loop because once I hear the loop, that's all I can hear.
Oh yeah, you start waiting for it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the loop's coming in 10 seconds.
Perfect. Yeah. And this is a distraction. And I have found, though, it's funny, you said sometimes you need the quiet, like writing nonfiction, it has to be quiet. I can't have even music. It's a totally, like writing fiction, I always played music and, you know, could have lyrics or not. It didn't bother me. And now with nonfiction, it has to be quiet.
Sometimes the lyrics are just, they're so distracting sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've become a big fan of like just water sounds, you know, in general, the rain or waves crashing or.
Yeah.
Those are always really nice.
Yeah. I do waves crashing for sleep. So I probably shouldn't try that for writing. Oh,
okay. That might not work out so well.
Like, what are you doing? Napping. I'm napping on the desk.
I need a different trigger.
Yeah. I'll do like thunderstorm or something.
Oh.
But yeah. Oh. So many things. So many things. I feel like we could talk about stuff forever. But I do want to be mindful of everyone's time, including yours. So before we do our little game of chance question at the end, I wanted to ask you, well, you just want to let people know where to find your stuff, what's going on. Like I said, this will come out the 1st of January. So,
oh, gosh, where to find me? My website is ladyalthea.com. It's A-L-T-H-A-E-A. and on social media, I'm at ladyalthea pretty much everywhere. I'm primarily active on Instagram at this point. I'm trying to be active on Threads, but it's hard because it's not the place that I want it to be. And
it's trying, but it's definitely not there yet.
No, it's trying to figure out what it is too. And I don't know. There's a lot of storytelling going on there. And I don't understand the reasoning behind like telling a story of something that happened when you were 12. Like every day on social media, like, oh, here's something that happened when I was like 22. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Just a lot of engagement farming and bait posting. And I got too much on my plate already to just want to hang out and like scroll through that all the time.
Yeah. We go back to the vibes are bad.
Vibes are bad. Yes. Oh yeah, I've got a Patreon too. I should also mention that is patreon.com/Althea. That is the paywall for the community that I safeguard. It's called The Winding Way. We do workshops. We have events throughout the month. There's something going on every single week. Like we've got the Polytheist and Animist support group where we basically work together to help each other unpack religious baggage. We talk about like the difficulties of living as an animist and a polytheist in this society, because it's not easy. You know, it's
No.
hard to adopt and further adopt and embrace a worldview that is just really contradictory to what we're encouraged to view things as and to act in ways. And we got a divination swap, we got a book club, we got workshops. There's a new workshop every month. Sometimes we do group energy work and things, and it's a lot of conversation, a lot of memes, a lot of cat and horse photos. Just there's silliness. It's fun.
Nice. And there'll be links for all of that in the show notes. And if you think of anything else, we'll throw those in too. And so our last question for everyone, like I said, is a little game of chance. I will roll a die and you'll get a question about death, sex, politics, or money? Religion. I left one out. Death, sex, religion, politics, money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. And because I don't like to put people on the spot, you can skip. You can say, I don't want to talk about that. So
Oh
then
gosh,
we'll roll
okay.
again. Let's see what our little purple die has in store today. Three, religion.
Ooh.
You want
All
that or you
right.
want to do something else?
Okay. I
Okay.
mean, I kind of talk about that a lot all the time, so maybe that's not
Yeah.
too bad.
So I had a question that was kind of talking about the Eastern influences of things like Shinto, but I think I want to ask you a different question. Because you brought up there toward the end about like just living in an overculture. Like I feel like there's this ongoing conversation about accepting what I think some people would still call new religious movements around like witchcraft and paganism and polytheism as being accepted like religions or acknowledged or whatever. And I see, for me personally, I see I'm of two minds about it. So I'm curious what your thoughts about that are. Is it important to be recognized as a religion, or does that complicate things?
Oh, I mean, it's God, big question. Actually, a big question. So if you look at like the general pagan movement over the last few decades, we had this huge thing in the 80s and 90s where we were constantly seeking validation from the overculture. We were always framing ourselves as what we are not, you know, oh, we're not Satanists. You know, we don't eat babies. It's just, you know, there's all of this like, we're just like you. We wear polos, we go to work. And yeah, in a lot of ways, it's understandable because you want people to recognize your humanity, that you are just another person. You know, your witches are literally the people in your neighborhood. You know, like there's so many of us just in the US alone that none of us is the only witch in our town anymore. No one is. Like,
No.
it's not, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. There are witches in your town, and you could be friends with them if we actually had a decent way to find each other, and we don't anymore because our jewelry is trendy. So we don't have even that anymore. But I feel like in a lot of ways, as understandable as it was that preoccupation kind of prevented us from doing the sort of intercommunity building that we needed to strengthen ourselves and to create just basic things that we need to things that just we need as a community. You know, everybody's a solitary, everybody feels alone. And yet there's so fucking many of us. You know, the Pew Research Center did that survey, and now they've scrubbed all of the results now from their website and from social media that stated that there were more witches in the US than there are Protestants in the US. So why are we all feeling so alone? Why are we having such trouble finding each other and finding that connection with community? Why have we not put in the effort to build those things or to help each other unpack our religious baggage so we can connect with each other more. So I'm less concerned about what other people think of me or think of our movements, religion, practices, all of it. And I'm far more concerned with us individually coming together and actually being community. And that's why, like, the bulk of my work too is, like I said, the Winding Way community, where we really focus on like being there for each other, unpacking the religious baggage, and just trying to be that little pocket that maybe ripples outwards and helps encourage other people to do that work. We deserve to have the things that we need to be okay. And, you know, we don't have to be alone. Yeah. I don't know, the search for validation and having acceptance from others, we're never going to have it in the US. We're not going to have it. Look at other religious minorities. It's not going to fucking happen, you know, and especially not going to happen if we can't tackle things like the anti-Semitism and the Islamophobia that's rampant in our own communities, within our own religions and practices. So it's a little hypocritical when we can't even scrub out that bigotry that is so common in our teaching material, in our books, in our conversations, in the social media posts, like in everything, in all aspects. Like, if we can't get that out of our community, how are we expecting the broader society to accept us? I mean, what, they're going to accept us because we have the same hate as them? Like, that's not a good thing.
No, that's such a good point too. Such a good point.
Yeah, it's wasted effort. I think it's wasted effort largely.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think the community building is priority, and
yeah,
I feel that about so many things right now. Like, community yes. building is really so important, and I think that's got to be the focus. You know, yeah. I feel like there's a lot coming that we need to be prepared for. And the only way we get through that is together.
And there's a lot right now, too. Just we all, like, everybody's feeling super overwhelmed. We feel a little bit less overwhelmed, though, when we're hanging out with each other, talking about how we feel overwhelmed. You know, community really does make it better. And community doesn't have to be a group of people that you have everything in common with and you agree with them on every subject. You know, community has to be diverse. It has to have different viewpoints and different foci and priorities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That, I think that's good wisdom to go out on. Althea, thank you so much. This has been such a joy, and I'm so glad that we finally got to chat, and
I'm
excited for all the things coming next for you.
Thank you so much.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com. And you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at WitchlitPod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.